Every day in the United States, 91 people die of opioid overdose. That includes prescription opiates and heroin. Over a year, that's more than 10 times the number of people who died on 9/11. And today on Second Thought, we're going to hear from some of the people struggling with addiction.
For, 15 years, all I knew was getting up and getting high. And so learning how to get up and brush my teeth and be an active member of society and take a shower every day and go and get a job interview and do all those things, I had to learn.
Those who offer help.
You have to address the issue of the opioid crisis. But then again, you do have patients that have acute problems and acute pain that need to be addressed.
And communities caught in the middle.
We're a small community. We take care of our own here, and we don't need problems from other communities brought into our community.
I'm Celeste Headley. GPB News presents Inside Georgia's Opioid Epidemic. Usually on Fridays, we bring you a roundup of the week's news in the break room. But today, we're breaking with tradition. You know that 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon game?
Okay, so I want to start at the end. Most of us have contemplated our own death. Who's going to be at the funeral and are they going to cry, stuff like that. I don't think that's morbid, honestly. I mean, I think it's okay to wonder about a world that doesn't have us in it. But I'm an actor, so the depths of my self-involvement runs very, very deep. This fantasy plays out a little differently for me. Bob Dylan once told me, never drop a name, I was on a airplane one time with Bruce Willis and Demi Moore and Nicole Kidman and Tom Cruise, and all I could think was, if this plane goes down, I'm not even going to make the headlines. So let's say I don't die in a crash with bigger stars than me, and I actually get an obituary. I've lately thought that it probably is going to read, actor Kevin Bacon, dead, no Oscars, but at least he has a game named after him. The 6 degrees.
Here's the basic idea. Everyone in Hollywood, no matter how famous or fringe, is connected to Kevin Bacon, the actor, by 6 or fewer acquaintances. Chances are your connection to the opioid crisis is even closer. Most of us are only a few steps away from someone who struggled. It may be a neighbor, a coworker, a friend, a family member, or even yourself. In the United States, we've got 5% of the world's population, but we consume more than 80% of the world's opiate supply. Some of that is legal. Think that hydrocodone your kid got when she had her wisdom teeth pulled. Some of that is illegal. Twice a week, a small group of volunteers operates Georgia's only syringe exchange in the hulking shadow of an abandoned stone church in Atlanta's English Avenue neighborhood. It's a place known as The Bluff. Intravenous drug users come here to trade their used needles for clean ones.
Yeah, 73, okay?
All right.
83.
My name is Dixie. I'm 22 years old, and I'm from Florida. With the way it started, me and heroin, I was just with friends, and I got the hang of it, I guess. There's fentanyl in almost every little bit that's out here. It's gotten to the point where people actually want to buy the fentanyl itself. People are starting to just be attracted to that because of how strong it is.
Okay, my name's Jeremy. I'm 26 years old. I started off with pain pills. I had to have them before I went to work. I couldn't work without them because it made me feel good, made me work good. And then one day, a guy that I met said, hey man, let's try this heroin. It's just like oxycodone. And once I started doing that drug, I didn't care about any other drug. I didn't realize it would take me this far. I would end up in the situation I'm in.
My name is John, 54. Heroin's done nothing but totally destroy my life. It's totally destroyed everyone's life around me and everything I love. There's no happiness, there's no joy. It's a very hateful relationship. You hate what you're doing every day. But if you don't do it, you can't live, you can't do anything. I'm so tired. I'm not getting any younger, you know what I mean? It's real tired, real tired.
And after a while, it just got really exhausting, and I was really tired of being tired all the time. My name is Lauren Krause, and I am 31 years old. We are in Sandy Springs. We are at a local church here, and I am getting ready to participate in a heroin anonymous fellowship. For 15 years, all I knew was getting up and getting high. And so learning how to get up and brush my teeth and be an active member of society and take a shower every day and go and get a job interview and do all those things, I had to learn. I had to literally have someone teach me how to do all of those things and be willing to be taught.
My name is Joe DeFabio. I'm 27 years old. You know, 6 months, 7 months, 9 months will go by and things are going well. I'm back in my family's life. I've got some career opportunities. I'm making some money. I'm starting to be self-supportive. And all those wonderful things that life has to offer, it's not enough. It's honestly not enough. There's still going to be this hole inside my heart. And that's where the HA Fellowship really came into play and put me on this path to achieve sobriety. And that absolutely has changed my life.
I'm Ariel. I'm 25 and I live in Roswell, Georgia. And now I just celebrated a year a few months ago, which like I couldn't even put like 60, 90 days together. So the fact that I could get to like a year is amazing. But I think what's been really, really hard is like having to basically have the willingness to do it all on my own. Like I wanted to stay clean and sober and I wanted to do this for myself. And it's a lot of forgiveness because like I was raised thinking that like if you do bad things, you're a bad person. Nobody ever told me like you're just a sick person trying to get well. So
just some of the people who struggle daily with opiate addiction. But what is going on in their brains? Why can some people experiment with drugs or take a painkiller and not become addicted, while others do very easily? Think of it this way. Imagine you haven't eaten in several days. What would you be thinking about? Food. Of course you would. Well, the craving for food is actually the brain's mechanism that drives you to survive. That's how many people describe what it's like to be addicted to opiates. Sam Snodgrass is one person who knows all too well about that craving. Snodgrass was addicted to heroin back in the late 1970s. All of this happened while he was working to study the effects of drugs on the brain as part of a postdoctoral fellowship to become a behavioral pharmacologist. Today, Snodgrass sits on the board of directors for Broken No More. It's an organization that helps with substance abuse recovery. He spoke with GPB's Leah Fleming.
We were doing research in the Behavioral Pharm Lab with just about every known drug that people like to use, and among those were a number of opiates. There had been a bottle of methadone hydrochloride, that's powdered methadone, and it had been rolling around in a drawer in the lab. And it wasn't in the safe. Most of the other drugs were always in the safe, but this one was just rolling around in a drawer, and I watched it rolling around that drawer for almost 2 years. And then one day, I got into it, and I did something with that methadone that I hadn't done with the heroin or the dilaudid, which is I started using it every day, and I started increasing my dose with it. And the whole time I was using that methadone, shooting that methadone, I told myself that when I finished that methadone, I would stop. And I really believed I could. But when I finished that bottle of methadone, I could not stop. I couldn't. Oh, and that started a 22-year run of addiction for me.
When you were using methadone, you said you found out that you could not stop. And that's because of the way opiates work in the brain. Tell us more about that. How do opiates work in the brain?
Okay, that's a great question. We are born with what is called an endogenous opioid system. Endogenous means from within. Right now, everybody that's listening to this has what are called endorphins. I'll just go with that one family. There are a number of different families of neuropeptides which interact with this system, but we'll go with just call them all endorphins. These endorphins are chemical structures that are just naturally occurring in your brain. And they bind with opioid receptor sites, which exist along neurons and form circuits within the brain. One of these circuits is connected to what is known as the pleasure or survival circuit within the brain. What happens with somebody, let's just as an example, takes a couple of hydrocodones. Those two hydrocodones flood the brain with far more opioids than the brain could ever produce on its own. And so we get, for those of us who are sensitive to the effects of these opioids, to the euphoria, we get a qualitatively different euphoria than we have ever felt before. It is like, wow, where has this been all my life? And our second thought is, wow, why can't I feel like this the rest of my life?
So is it all opioids like fentanyl and heroin and OxyContin? Is it all the same, or do they each one of them kind of do something different?
No, there's all a basic opioid feeling to all of these. Yes, they're all a little bit different. They're all going to give slightly different effects. But the main thing is that they all produce that same type of opioid euphoria in us. Of course, again, there are some differences within them. We can tell whether we've taken hydrocodones or we've taken heroin. But that underlying euphoria is still there.
Is the brain forever altered by opioid abuse?
That's a very good question. And nobody really knows the answer to that one. The most I've seen is they've done some functional magnetic resonance imaging studies of people who haven't used opioid for 4 or 5 years. And there were still significant changes within the brain, even after that time. Whether the brain ever goes back to the way it was before somebody became addicted, altered their brain from a non-addicted to an addicted state with opioids, nobody can answer that one at this point.
Okay.
This really is a lifelong chronic condition.
Should someone be concerned if a doctor prescribes an opiate for pain? Like, what questions should we ask? How do we know if we'll become addicted? I know I was just prescribed an opiate for a shoulder cuff injury at the gym, but I've really been afraid to take it. I have taken it, but I've been afraid of that. What would you say?
Okay. That's really a fairly easy thing to answer. If you take it and you don't really like it, then you're probably not going to have a problem with it. We don't do things that don't make us feel good. We tend to not do them. If you take that opioid and it's like the sun came out from a rainy day, it's like you're feeling this great, wonderful feeling, then that's probably a sign that you should be very careful. So if you take these things and they make you feel great, you know, that's a sign. The really crucial sign is if you go from, say, 2 a day to 4 a day, and then you go from 4 to 6. Tolerance is a sign, a signal that you are changing the structure of your brain. And if you don't stop, and you don't stop now, you may very well not be able to stop. Most of us get to a point to where we're not getting that euphoria anymore. We've reached a point to where all we're trying to do is to remain functional. So we go out, we do whatever we have to do to get enough to make it through the day. And then we get up tomorrow and we do the same thing. It is really like being on a hamster wheel. And for so many of us, we can't figure a way to get out or off of that hamster wheel.
But you actually did get off the wheel and you are now opiate free, aren't you? You're drug free?
At this point, yes, at this point, but I have to emphasize very much that just because I'm not using today does not mean I will not be using next week. I cannot promise you that next week that won't be me. I'm not on medication. If I was on buprenorphine, if I was on methadone, I could make that promise to you, but I'm not, so I can't.
Sam Snodgrass is a recovering heroin addict who sits on the board of a substance abuse recovery organization called Broken No More. He talked with GPB's Leah Fleming by Skype. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Here's a startling fact. The number of overdose deaths nationwide jumped 72% between 2014 and 2015. Over just 2 days in June, 33 people OD'd on opiates in central Georgia. 5 of them died. Law enforcement tied that outbreak to a street version of Percocet laced with counterfeit fentanyl. The Centers for Disease Control say fentanyl is 50 times more potent than heroin and 100 times more potent than morphine. It's dangerous, and it's changing the way law enforcement does its job. GPB's Josephine Bennett reports.
I felt like my body was shutting down. People around me said that I looked really white, I lost color, and it just really felt like, thought that was it, I thought I was dying.
That's New Jersey Detective Eric Price speaking in a Department of Justice video about his exposure to fentanyl. He and investigator Dan Callen came in contact with the drug while on a routine call.
Couldn't breathe. Very disoriented. And everything you did was exaggerated in your mind, I guess. It was the most bizarre feeling that I never, ever would want to feel again, to be honest with you.
But it's a growing danger for police everywhere, including Macon.
All right, we're going to get started so we can get y'all out of here. Y'all down here, we are doing the Narcan training while you're down here.
Over a week, 350 Macon officers are being trained to administer Narcan, a drug that can reverse the effects of an overdose. It comes in a little green pouch the size of a man's wallet. They get one dose in a nasal Narcan injector. Captain David Freeland runs the training center for the Bibb County Sheriff's Office.
We're getting out to just about everybody that can get a kit. We're going to give some out to the jail, some to the courthouse, definitely to the road deputies, investigators like the gang unit and drug unit who might come in contact with the stuff firsthand.
Fentanyl is more powerful than morphine and heroin. Breathing or touching just a few particles can kill you.
When first responders get on the scene, if this powder or tablet, if they touch it with their fingers, they absorb the chemical and have the same effects and end up overdosed on the medication because they're trying to help the people that are, you know, that have taken it to start with.
That's Dr. Chris Hendry, the chief medical officer with Navicent Health, where 17 of the overdose patients were treated. He says wearing gloves and face masks is new for police.
Sometimes in the heat of the moment when you're responding and it's an emergency, you know, you want to get in on the scene and act as quickly as possible to help the people that need it. But now you have to make sure that you're protecting yourself as well.
Tony Brown has been a paramedic for 20 years and runs EMS operations for Navicent. He says in the last few years, they've seen a steady rise in overdoses, but the June outbreak was sudden and severe.
It became apparent through conversations with different physicians that this substance was more potent than what we were normally dealing with, and that the dosages of Narcan needed to be increased by a good amount.
And while paramedics carry ample Narcan supplies administered via IV, police only have one dose. Captain Freeland.
So it's going to be there for you to use in case you run across somebody that is overdosing on this, but it's also there for your protection.
But whether they use it to treat themselves or someone in the throes of an overdose is not part of the training. That difficult decision will be left up to police.
Okay, I thought they were going to move it.
For GPB News, I'm Josephine Bennett in Macon.
Drugs like fentanyl aren't just creating new risks for human police officers. The dogs who use their powerful noses to sniff out drugs are inhaling the dangerous synthetic opioids as well. As GPB's Emily Jones reports, police departments are taking new steps to protect their dogs and respond if the canines get sick.
If you're a police dog and somebody runs at your human waving a weapon, there's only one response. You attack. Luckily for everyone involved, this is just a drill. The attacker is another officer wearing a big protective pad so the dog doesn't bite through his arm. But these dogs are ready to defend their handlers, and they're good at it.
These are the best of the best of the dogs that come through the police program, because it takes a very special type of dog to be willing to do the patrol work.
That's Corporal Benjamin Ferrero with the Savannah-Chatham Police Department. The patrol work he does involves tracking down and apprehending suspects. He and his dog Dooley also work on narcotics, sniffing for drugs. And with dangerous synthetic opioids flooding the streets, Ferrero says it's now his turn to keep his dog safe.
They're our partners, they're our best friends, and we ask them to do a lot for us that's dangerous, and they do it happily and willingly without hesitation for us. So we're trying to do as much as we can to protect them.
That means changing how police use their dogs. The canines can still sniff outside, say, a car to check whether there are drugs somewhere inside, but the officers aren't sending them in to find the stash itself. Ferrero says there could be fentanyl in any drugs the dog finds, not just in cases obviously involving heroin or prescription pills.
It's being mixed with marijuana, it's being mixed with heroin and cocaine, and even in its pure form, it's so dangerous and it's so highly concentrated, people just don't understand the danger that's coming with it.
The equivalent of a few grains of salt can make a human officer sick, and it takes even less for a dog. David Furland of the United States Police Canine Association says he's hearing concerns like this from departments throughout the country, and some dogs have been exposed.
Oh, anecdotally, I probably receive probably a half dozen reports each month of agencies or canine units that have deployed Narcan or something else or otherwise had their dogs somewhat ODing on exposure to some of these drugs.
Narcan, or naloxone, is the overdose-reversing drug that police departments increasingly carry to keep both officers and civilians safe. For people, it's a nasal spray. Furland and veterinarians say that's worked for dogs who've been exposed. But clinical trials in dogs have only looked at injections. And in Georgia, medicine used on a dog has to be prescribed by a veterinarian. So either way, police dogs need their own separate doses of the expensive drug. Ferrero says they're working on it.
We're trying to get it to where we can have it and be prepared for any situation we come across. But it's just one of those things where it's so new and it's happening so fast that we're catching up on the curve.
In the meantime, the officers are carrying charcoal to induce vomiting if need be and keeping a careful eye on the dogs in case they're exposed. Furland says police officers, especially in narcotics, are worried about their dogs sniffing dangerous drugs. But he says ultimately that doesn't change much.
Just because there is a risk doesn't mean that we don't go into that threat area. It just means we need to be properly trained. We need to be careful. We need to be properly equipped.
Police in Savannah are working on just that kind of training and on how to respond to protect their dogs from opioids. For GPB News, I'm Emily Jones in Savannah.
Around 75% of heroin users started with a prescription opioid, drugs like OxyContin, Vicodin, and Percocet. Here's former U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy.
We have currently nearly 250 million prescriptions for opioids written every year. That's enough for every adult in America to have a bottle of pills and then some.
The prescription opioid business is big, $10 billion a year big. A team of journalists with the Center for Public Integrity has been investigating how pharmaceutical companies are profiting from the opioid epidemic. GPB's Ricky Bevington talks with reporter Liz Esley White about their findings.
One of the things we looked at in our reporting was a type of opioid that was supposed to be harder to abuse. In recent years, more and more doctors have been encouraged to prescribe what are called abuse deterrent opioids. And these are drugs that are supposed to be harder to misuse. They also happen to make the drug company more money. They're more lucrative. They were something that came about because of the crisis, and now drug companies are profiting off of them.
Are they in fact less addictive to patients?
Experts say that there's no real proof that these drugs help people stay away from addiction. But doctors have a false impression of how they work and are more likely to tell patients that they're not as addictive.
Here in Georgia, can you paint the picture of this particular problem? Pharmaceutical companies in our state trying to profit off of it.
Yeah, Georgia, like a lot of states, has seen more and more people die from drug overdoses. The number of people dying from drugs went up 45% from 2006 to 2014. That decade had 9,000 plus people die from drugs, a lot of those from opioids or heroin. that's partly fueled by a rash of overprescribing, doctors just handing out too many of these pills. In Georgia, that was in 2015, 0.77 prescriptions per person, meaning almost one prescription for every single person in Georgia of opioids. The popularity of these drugs is backed up in many places by political power of their makers. In Georgia, opioid makers and their allies gave $1.3 million total from 2006 to 2014 to Georgia politicians, political parties. They also had an average of 41 lobbyists in the Georgia State House every year to back up their drugs and vouch for bills that supported their drugs.
Why have doctors allowed this to happen? They are the ones writing these prescriptions.
Yeah, I think you're starting to see the ship change course on this gradually. But the reason it got this way was for a long time, these drugs were heavily marketed. In addition, we found at the Center for Public Integrity that the pharmaceutical companies, with their immense state house political power, went state by state and passed these laws in the 1990s and later on, encouraging doctors to use opioids, encouraging the medical community to believe that pain was something that did not need to go untreated, and that one of the first lines of defense against pain could be a prescription drug, opioid. Doctors got the wrong impression. Now that education is shifting, and doctors are starting to realize this is a real crisis. We need to not be so quick to hand them out, but in a lot of cases, the damage is already done. And those people, in a lot of cases, people who got addicted to heroin started on those prescription opioids.
Liz Esley White was part of a team of journalists with the Center for Public Integrity. That team has been looking into how drug companies are profiting from the opioid epidemic. She spoke with GPB's Ricky Bevington. How do you fight pain while fighting addiction? That's a question that's on the mind of healthcare providers all over rural Georgia. In these settings where doctors are scarce, nurses and physician's assistants are key providers of care. But some worry the state's effort to fight opioid abuse has left those providers without an important tool.
It's a weekday morning at Optum Medical Center in Sylvania, about 60 miles northwest of Savannah. And for now, things are slow. Tina Hood is a physician's assistant here.
Like in any ER, it's feast or famine. You know, you're going to have a great day or either you're going to have a very busy day.
Doctors are scarce in rural Georgia. PAs and nurses provide much of the care in hospitals like this one. Still, about 10% of people who come to Optum's ER are sent to larger facilities in cities like Savannah. And Hood says it's been harder to meet patients' needs since PAs lost an important tool, hydrocodone.
You have to address the issue of the opioid crisis. But then again, you do have patients that have acute problems and acute pain that need to be addressed.
In 2014, the Drug Enforcement Agency put drugs like Lortab and Vicodin in a class with opioids like morphine. PAs lost the ability to prescribe them. Now, Hood sees patients with kidney stones and bone fractures and can't give them stronger pain medicine.
It boils down to a very simple thing. We're obligated to provide our emergency room personnel with what they need in order to care for the patient.
Robert Sellers is CEO of the hospital, which needs patients to stay financially healthy. He says unhappy patients stop coming and estimates a handful a month move on because they can't get hydrocodone.
You're just going to skip this step and go on to another facility 30 miles away that you know that have those resources that you need. Whereas if we had that pain medication on board, then we could care for you here.
The problem was almost solved earlier this year. The Georgia legislature passed a bill allowing PAs to prescribe small amounts of hydrocodone. But Governor Nathan Deal vetoed the measure, arguing more prescribers could lead to more opioid abuse.
Dear Governor Deal, both of my nieces have gone through drug rehabilitation because of opioid-based drugs.
Republican Representative Deborah Silcox wrote a letter to the governor asking him to veto the bill. Silcox says she's not trying to make it harder for rural Georgians to get the care they need.
I just think that it's critical that we stem the tide of the number of prescriptions being written, and I think to the degree we can control that, that it's better policy for Georgia.
We've got to change this attitude that all pain is bad. We have to eliminate all pain. No, that may not be possible.
Jim Langford runs the Georgia Prevention Project, a nonprofit working to curb substance abuse. This year, lawmakers passed stricter rules for how doctors report opioid prescriptions. Langford says Georgia should give those rules time to take effect before adding thousands more prescribers to the system.
Maybe we can come back to that issue and revisit that. Right now, I think what we've got to do is just get control of what's happening.
There are patients who show up for treatment and are in pain. And the question we have is, how do you treat that pain?
Jason Hockenberry studies public health at Emory University.
You can imagine that the more prescribers that are out there and available, the people that are addicted to these medications would have more opportunities to shop around and find what I would call a soft spot in the system.
But Hockenberry says that's not borne out by the data, which makes problems like these so hard to solve.
I've had patients that have had, you know, facial bone fractures, multiple facial bone fractures. They're obviously in pain. And makes you very humble to know that you can't provide them with the care that they need.
Back in a rural ER, Tina Hood says she knows there's an opioid crisis and she doesn't want to become a part of it. But she also wants the tools to help patients in pain. For GPB News, I'm Sam Whitehead.
This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. While there's no question the opioid epidemic touches every part of our country, the most recent numbers from the CDC suggest the problem is in decline in some places. That includes Albany, Georgia. That's in the southwest corner of the state. Dr. James Black is the director of emergency medicine at Phoebe Putney Medical Center in Albany. He says he knows his community is better off than some, but he's still painfully aware of opiate overdoses.
On the last shift I worked, in the emergency department during my 10-hour shift, we had at least four that I'm aware of. And I've had cases where people drop people off to the front door of the hospital and the patient's blue and not breathing. You know, is that an everyday occurrence where I have four during my shift? No, but it's not an uncommon occurrence, if that makes sense. It is an issue in southwest Georgia. Make no mistake about it. But now, when you're approaching every patient, in the back of your mind, you also want to know, is there something else that may be involved, such as drug use or abuse? Well, some people will frankly tell you, you know, I'm out of my medication, I'm having pain, I need you to treat it. Others are kind of circumspect when they're giving you their opinion on things, but we become more attuned to it and we can quickly identify those that may have, you know, other agenda. So they'll complain of things that are hard to detect or it takes time to detect, hoping to get some opioids on the front end. It's something we have to do more research on. You know, we're searching the prescription drug monitoring database, where our own electronic health record allows us to also comb through prescriptions. So it's becoming routine to do that kind of investigation. When you sign up through the Drug Enforcement Agency, the DEA, we're actually able to type their name in and find out what prescriptions they've been written for, whether they have active and open prescriptions. And not too infrequently, you will find out where people have gone to several different locations hoping to get prescriptions written. You'd be surprised at the number of people who go to several different cities in a day's time seeking those prescription medications.
You got to figure out why.
If you see a pattern, then we're less likely to prescribe any medication at that point in time. When you discharge a patient home, again, the new Georgia laws are going to be that we prescribe no more than 3 days of medication or no more than 26 pills. That is a lot. So we don't approach those numbers.
She's in a stroke room.
It's kind of common knowledge you're not going to get more than 3 days of medication and more than 10 or 12 pills, much less than the 26. You know, we're not going to be easy prey, so to speak, for people with repeated usage of this.
Dr. James Black is director of emergency medicine at Phoebe Putney Medical Center in Albany, Georgia. Treating overdose is hard, but if you're a civilian, witnessing a drug overdose can be truly frightening. Many people who find themselves in that situation are hesitant to dial 911 for fear of the consequences. 3 years ago, Georgia passed a medical amnesty law that offers limited legal protection for overdose victims and those who call for medical assistance. GPB's Taylor Gant takes a look at that law and how it's being put to use.
The push for medical amnesty all started with a group of parents who lost children to drug overdose. Robin Elliott was one of them.
My son, Zach, was a private school student in Buckhead. He was a beautiful, bright, talented kid, and he also used heroin.
Zach was a multi-sport athlete and a solid student, but he wasn't able to overcome his addiction even after multiple trips to rehab. Robin still remembers the phone call she received on May 1st, 2011.
They found his body in the backseat of his grandparents' car in the English Avenue neighborhood in Atlanta.
Zach died of a heroin overdose. He was 21. After his death, Robin co-founded the group Georgia Overdose Prevention. She and other parents shared their stories of loss with legislators across the state, including Republican Representative Sharon Cooper of Marietta.
I still get chill bumps about this.
She reflects on the story of a young man who was abandoned by his friends during an overdose.
They let him die, and then they dumped his body on his mother's front lawn so she would find it when she came home from church.
Cooper wanted to help, so she sponsored the bill that created Georgia's 911 medical amnesty law. It's got two main functions. It allows more people access to the overdose prevention drug naloxone, and it establishes legal protection for those seeking help in the event of a drug-related emergency. That applies to overdose victims and the person calling for medical assistance. Joe DeFabio has been on both sides of that call as a former heroin user. He says before medical amnesty, he would still call 911 if a friend was ODing, just not right away.
We would flush everything. As our friend is, you know, going into respiratory failure, hold on, first things first, let's get rid of all the evidence. Then we'll go ahead and call it. You know, we'll take our chances with it.
After the law was passed in 2014, Joe overdosed 8 times in a 6-week period. He says the new regulations made getting help much easier.
They didn't search me. They didn't search through my pockets. They came. They revived me. They brought me back to the hospital. They monitored me, make sure that my heart rate was steady. And then they would keep me overnight and then discharge me the next morning.
According to research from the libertarian think tank Cato Institute, medical amnesty laws, combined with better access to naloxone, have made a real difference. States that utilize the methods have seen up to an 11% decrease in overdose deaths. But those benefits can still be hard to keep track of.
If this law works the way the legislature intended, then in reality, prosecutors, DAs, offices like ours should never see the case.
That's Vic Reynolds. He's the district attorney for Cobb County. He says although specific stats are hard to come by, the law is working well. Officers accompany EMTs after an overdose call is received. If the factors are right, no charges are filed, no arrests are made. But, he says, 3 years after the medical amnesty law passed, there is still a lot of confusion about it.
People need to seek help, and they need to understand that if they do, and they have a possession amount of drugs, then they will not be charged criminally.
Public awareness is key, says Reynolds. Because if people don't know the law exists, they might not pick up the phone when it matters the most. For GPB News, I'm Taylor Gant in Atlanta.
This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. A new kind of tourist is visiting Georgia, and they're not here for our national parks, beaches, or aquariums. They're here for methadone. That's a drug that treats opioid addiction by blocking withdrawal symptoms. Georgia has more than 70 clinics, the most of any state in the South. GPB's Olivia Reingold brings us this story from the state's northwest corner, where many of these clinics are clustered.
Lisa Kidd drove 2 hours to be here today at the Chatsworth Treatment Center, Counseling Solutions.
You can go on up to window 2.
She's here just like she is every 27 days to pick up about a month's worth of methadone. The nurse hands her 27 pill bottles in a row. And one after the other, Kid throws them in a lockbox.
It don't matter how I put them in here because once I get back to Tennessee, next to the Smokies, they're going to be everywhere anyway.
The nurse hands her another dose. This one's for today.
All right, thank you.
Kid's been on methadone for almost 30 years. She says it's the only thing that's been able to pull her out of her opiates addiction.
I've went into treatment. So many treatment centers, I can't even think of all of them, and they just didn't work for me.
So she drives 2 hours from Wallen, Tennessee to Chatsworth, Georgia, every 27 days. She has closer options. Knoxville has 2 clinics, but she says that those are too expensive.
I don't know. I can't afford the prices that they have in my hometown.
Methadone isn't the only thing that brings Lisa Kidd to Northwest Georgia.
Hi, Lisa.
Hey.
She gets counseling, too, from Zach Talbot, who owns and operates this clinic. Zach himself is from Tennessee, and he wanted to open an opiate treatment program back home, but he said it was too difficult under the current regulations. So he opened up in Chatsworth, Georgia, 20 miles from the Tennessee border.
When we opened, we were the only
opioid treatment program in our county and in all the counties that border us. And so I wanted to come to an area that needed treatment.
This bothers some Chatsworth residents. Two stoplights down from Talbot's clinic, it's lunchtime at the Brass Lantern, a cafeteria-style meat-and-three-sides kind of place. A local construction worker points me in the direction of Judge Eric Hooker, who's in the middle of lunch with colleagues.
We're a small community. We take care of our own here, and we don't need problems from other communities brought into our community.
This isn't just an issue for Chatsworth or Murray County. It's something that all of Northwest Georgia is dealing with. In Catoosa County, Sheriff Gary Sisk says opiates are ravaging his community.
We're seeing our young people dying left and right. And this is a huge problem, a definite problem.
He just doesn't know if methadone is the answer for people in his community or others.
Don't get me wrong. I'm not totally against methadone clinics. I'm just saying we have enough that everybody doesn't need to pile up on the state line just because it's more complicated to go into another state.
Georgia has 72 methadone clinics. Tennessee has 12.
It's not that there isn't any methadone clinics in the state of Tennessee. There are answers within their own jurisdiction and with their own boundaries. I have my own home area that I have to look after.
But even for his own residents, Sheriff Sisk is skeptical about whether this stuff even works.
And I do have an issue that there is no push for anyone on methadone to wean off of methadone. And to be honest, I mean, look at it. A methadone clinic is in the business to make money. Why would they want to wean their clients off of methadone?
Neil Campbell's heard that one before. She's executive director of the Georgia Council on Substance Abuse. And she says, sure, methadone can go wrong.
Oh, it absolutely can be abused, and it can be harmful. It can be dangerous. You can overdose from methadone as well. There are people who have overdosed and died from methadone.
But she says when coupled with counseling, there's a good chance it could go right.
When it's prescribed and it's used in the right way, along with a behavioral therapy, it's highly successful in treating opiate addiction.
Still, she admits that Sheriff Sisk may be onto something.
They may be right. It may be, there may be some nefarious things going on in those clinics, but if they're well-run clinics that are well-regulated and operated, I think they would change their minds.
A bill that passed the Georgia General Assembly this past spring increases regulation for methadone clinics. It limits how many clinics a region can have. Still, the price of treatment in neighboring states may keep methadone tourists flocking to Georgia. It can cost up to $40 a week more in Tennessee than it does here. And that's enough to keep people like Lisa Kidd driving 2 hours each way every 27 days to Northwest Georgia. For GPB News, I'm Olivia Reingold.
The opioid epidemic isn't just causing tension in communities with methadone clinics. It's also raising a lot of questions for businesses, particularly in rural areas of the state. Georgia's unemployment rate is at record lows, but some companies are having trouble finding workers who can pass a drug test. GPB's Stephen Fowler has this story from Stevens County in Northeast Georgia.
Now, hiring. Two words that are a blessing to job seekers have become a curse for Barry Roberts. He's the director of operations at ASI Southeast in East Denali and is desperate to find workers who can pass a drug test. Amidst the sounds of whirring pistons and beeping forklifts, Roberts tells me prescription opioids aren't just keeping skilled positions unfilled.
So it's very important that we can find people that are qualified to come in and do the entry-level jobs. And that's one of the things that's become increasingly difficult, is just to find the entry-level people.
ASI mainly makes plastic partitions used in bathroom stalls for places like the new Braves and Falcons stadiums and the Atlanta airport. And most of the 400-plus jobs are labor-intensive. Robert says there's been a sharp increase all around Stevens County of people that aren't passing drug tests for the same reason.
We're seeing more people using prescription drugs, abusing prescription drugs. Those are easy to get, and so we're seeing a growth in that over the past couple of years.
It's a conundrum for a county that only has a 4.8% unemployment rate, but it's having real consequences. ASI is the largest private employer in the county, so their unfilled jobs don't go unnoticed.
I would go as far to say as our economy as a whole is being affected by this drug problem, because we can't find workers.
The rise in prescription opioid abuse impacts the nation's economy, too. A recent study by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the nationwide economic cost of prescription opioid abuse was over $78 billion in 2013. To give a sense of the scale, that's nearly 8 times the economic impact of Georgia's booming film industry and slightly more than the state's agribusiness. Dr. Curtis Florence is the CDC's lead health economist and author of the study. He says healthcare costs are already rising for many businesses, and opioid abuse only adds to that burden.
We estimated healthcare costs per year are going to go up by over $15,000. In many cases, those are costs that are going to be paid by an employer.
Additionally, Florence says a prescription opioid abuser earns about $8,400 less a year than the average American worker due to lower levels of productivity from the drugs. In mid-June, the newly formed Georgia House Rural Development Council met in the county seat of Toccoa to hear the successes and challenges facing Stevens County businesses. Barry Roberts was the first speaker. At the time of his presentation, nearly 30 jobs were open at ASI, and some had been posted for more than a year. After the presentation, council member Dominic Laricchia, a state lawmaker from Southeast Georgia, told Roberts community members needed to step up.
So I would challenge you, these local industries and leaders, to stand in front of your people and say, your brothers and sisters and sons and daughters are on drugs, they will not work, and we need their help to be successful to support this community.
Back on the factory floor, Roberts let out a long, deep sigh. The efforts of folks in Stevens County can only go so far to make a difference, he says. Passion and exasperation fill his voice as he shares the same message he gave the Rural Development Council.
I'd like to see more state money put toward addressing the opioid drug problem, because I think it's something that we've talked about, it's something we realized, but if you look at the statistics, it's still going up.
In the meantime, ASI is building a new $16 million manufacturing center right down the road from its main facility. When it opens, one of the first things you'll see is a sign, now hiring. For GPB News, I'm Stephen Fowler in East Denali, Georgia.
Georgia's opioid crisis cuts across race, class, and age, and solving this nationwide public health emergency is no easy task. But all across Georgia, people are working to curb the epidemic. We've got more of their stories, as well as resources for treatment and advice on how to safely dispose of prescription opiates at our website, gpbnews.org. Thank you so much for joining us today. I'm Celeste Headley. This has been a special GPB News Presents Inside Georgia's Opioid Epidemic.